Meade has found is that when you work with linearity, you have to have more and more power. The larger computer that you build in a digital fashion, the more power you have to have. And one of the problems of limitation of size and capacity is cooling. By shifting to silicon chips that work along neural lines, the power that's required becomes infinitesimally small. They work better and better with less and less power. Do you understand the paradox? Can you imagine the revolution? When you move to a neural silicon chip, the computer uses infinitesimal power, almost not noticeable. How much power does the human nervous system use in terms of wattage? He has the figure in here. It's not very large at all. It's on the order of hundreds, thousands of a watt. Can you understand what this does to the paradigm of power as the index of achievement? Can you imagine the humility of the would-be Caesars to recognize that you outclassed them by millions of orders of capacity with hundreds of thousands of power? Do you also understand the spiritual statement that the deep self works effortlessly, no power at all? It doesn't draw on any power source at all. Zero power, infinite capacity. Do you see where Meade is heading, even though he doesn't want to say it's a spiritual discipline? He's heading towards a meeting with what Niels Bohr 50 years ago saw. That there is a very odd sense to the real, which evidently man is capable of realizing. He would be, under normal circumstances, forever forbidden by impossible limits to even know of its existence, except for the very esoteric and arcane fact that man has ability to transform even out of his entire heritage into something completely novel, completely new, never before seen, and completely supernatural. In other words, man can exist not only on every level of nature, but even on the supernatural level, and still exist. It's a sobering thought to would-be dictators. I must say this again to you so that you can take heart. Even one free human being on the planet will unravel the empire. What's the myth? The Empire has to kill every Jedi knight, that if even one escapes, the Empire is doomed? That's right. That's right. And so however humble it looks, the good man with his hands in his pockets, standing in the snowstorm, just standing there in the right way, rights the entire world. It's a sobering fact to would-be Caesars. Let's go to Bohr. This philosophy of Niels Bohr by Henry Fulsey, published in 1985, in the Netherlands. I believe it's available from Caltech's bookstore. chapter 1, what is complementarity? Late in his life, Niels Bohr remarked, "I think that it would be reasonable to say that no man who is called a philosopher really understands what is meant by the complementary descriptions." Now that turns us around a little bit. "I think it would be reasonable to say that no man who is called a philosopher really understands what is meant by the complementary descriptions." In other words, if you have a philosophic stance in advance, no matter what it is, you are not understanding what's happening. We have to not only jettison all metaphysical diagrams and systems, but all philosophies. Now, the traditional ascription to that state where you have no philosophy of life, no metaphysical convictions or aspirations, that state is called traditionally nihilism. And if you're looking for darkness, nihilism actually in the mind is as dark as you can get. It's like black on black. That's exactly, excuse me for telling you, it's exactly where we have to go. And you have to understand that that darkness is not something, but it is actually nothing. And that's why it doesn't affect you in any way whatsoever. You are totally free in that condition, free to be just as you are. The darkness has no hands to grab you, no horns to gore you, no voice to throttle you. Do you understand that there is absolutely nothing to fear in that absolute darkness? But one has to experience that in order to experience the fearlessness that's there. That's why the teaching mudra, the hand that I use, this is the teaching mudra, also stands for fearlessness. What could you teach to someone? The only thing that you can really teach is fearlessness, because once they experience that, they can teach themselves whatever they need to know, because they can see what is what. A human being who is able to see what's what teaches themselves very quickly what they really need to know. If you don't have the stigmatisms in your mind and the inaccuracies of your assumptions, you can quickly see what everything is for and put together a working life. That's no problem whatsoever. It's like a Robinson Crusoe who's maybe marooned, but marooned in a situation where everything one would need is right there. And you can put together whatever you need for whatever life you need. Late in his life, Niels Bohr remarked, "I think that it would be reasonable to say that no man who is called a philosopher really understands what is meant by the complementary descriptions." It's like Lao Tzu saying, "The Tao that is the Tao has no name, but the Tao that has a name is the mother of the 10,000 things." Pulsey goes on to say, "That somewhat wistful comment by this great pioneer of modern atomic theory is as sadly true today as it was over 50 years ago when Bohr first formulated the philosophy he called complementarity. This book aspires to remedy that situation by presenting Bohr's philosophy as a consistent and comprehensive framework for the objective description of nature." He uses the term framework here, and he likes the term framework The reason that he does is that there's a connotation to the English word framework that it is a provisional structure. In other words, it's not a structure which is eternally there, but it's provisionally there because we're using it. And as soon as we stop using it, we don't have to think about it again. So he uses framework. It's like when you're building something, you put a framework up just to build it. The framework in itself has only one function, to allow you to create. And when you're through with your creation, the framework is extraneous. It's the same idea as the Buddha saying, you need only to have a raft to cross to the other shore. The raft is not important. It's hard to tell this to the Buddhist monks who take such pride in their robes, that it's extraneous. Pardon me, I get worked up. Do you understand that in the Buddha's life, the robes were made out of scraps? In the spring, when new clothing was made for the family, and when the women were through making the clothing for the family, they threw out in the trash the leftovers. And it was from these leftovers that the original Buddhist monks made their own robes. They made them fresh out of the scraps every year. Not out of rags, but out of the scraps that were thrown away. No usable piece of cloth could be used. And along with carrying the begging bowl, the monk carried a needle. You were allowed very few things. You were allowed your robe, which you made. You were allowed a heavier cloak for inclement weather. You were allowed a bowl. You were allowed a needle, and you were allowed shoes, sandals. That's it. Complete wardrobe. You made your robe new every spring out of scraps. You made it yourself, so that the original Buddhist robes were like a quilt, like a grandmother's crazy quilt. They had no patterns to them whatsoever. Do you understand? These beautiful robes of fine gray and fine black and fine saffron are an abomination to the spirit of the Buddha. Absolute abomination. And to take pride in your beautiful robes is the worst of arrogance. Pardon me, I need to editorialize occasionally. Framework. The original Buddhist robe was just a framework. And so the author here, Fulci, is using that because he struggled to find a word which wouldn't be structure, because what Boris is talking about is truly new. New to the West, very, very ancient. Plotinus understood it. Patanjali understood it. Nagarjuna understood it, but it's new to us. So this book aspires to remedy that situation by presenting Bohr's philosophy as a consistent and comprehensive framework for the objective description of nature. In other words, the only philosophy that's workable is a framework which is dispensable. So you're using a philosophy which is intentionally provisional. You must understand consciously this is only provisional, so that when it begins to fray and not work and fall apart, instead of trying to patch it up by covering up and seeking to be more certain and powerful, you let it fall apart. Do you understand the excellence in the humility of that? When you begin to see your philosophy framework fall apart, you know that you're maturing. The good man leaving a trail of discarded fragments of belief walks naked into the real. I'm using dramatic language in order to convey to you that this is a very radical process. Instead of being secure with the protection of an amulet, which is true in natural development, you now have to be able to be open in a talismanic expression of your nudity in the universe, to know that you have no protection. None is needed. You understand that the natural thing was to integrate, and the conscious thing is to differentiate, to open up. And that if you're still trying to integrate in a clever way your differentiation, you're bastardizing the whole process. To look for a new and more powerful integration to carry man into the space age is a bastardization of the whole procedure. One has to be, what's the phrase? Wise as a serpent, gentle as a dove. You have to use less and less power and more prajna till your wisdom becomes spontaneous with no power at all. It's like that. So that here we have before beginning our analysis of complementarity, it will aid our understanding to recognize what is involved in identifying its genus as a conceptual framework. Thus, in the first section of this opening chapter, I will present what Bohr meant by proposing complementarity as a conceptual framework for the description of nature, but I must do this before having the chance to develop the arguments by which he arrived at his framework. Hopefully, whatever loss in dramatic presentation results from this foreknowledge of our goal will be offset by a greater ease in following the arguments in chapters to come. In order to clear the way for our understanding of complementarity, in the following sections, I shall consider several common misconceptions about complementarity and how they arose, and then turn to the significance of complementarity as a framework. I'm going to end today by jumping over here to a statement that Bohr himself made about learning, about epistemology, about understanding how you learn and what you learn. And I'm going to end with this statement, and we'll begin next week with this statement and open it up, amplify it. This is Bohr himself. Often the development of physics has taught us that a consistent application of even the most elementary concepts indispensable for the description of our daily experience is based on assumptions initially unnoticed, the explicit consideration of which is, however, essential if we wish to obtain a classification of more extended domains of experience as clear and as free from arbitrariness as possible. This development has contributed to the general philosophic clarification of the principles underlying human knowledge. We have, nevertheless, received only recently an incisive admonition that the analysis of new experience, novel, is liable to disclose again and again the unrecognized presuppositions for an unambiguous use of our most simple concepts, such as space-time description and causality. In other words, the peculiarity is that every time a new situation happens, one needs to renew then and there your consciousness of what presuppositions are operative and working. This takes the principle of bare attention down to the subnuclear level. It takes the Satipatthana of the Buddha down to levels that classically used to be called Abhidharma. Abhidharma. Beyond the Dharma. If you carry a worldly, unspoken egotism there, you will experience that as a chaos. You will not experience the primordiality of its nature, with quotation marks, because the supernatural has its own nature. The supernatural is, to use just a colloquial thing, is not nature, it's not natural. The supernatural is not natural. Man, when he is free, is spiritual, not worldly at all. Not worldly at all. Well, I hope next week we'll start here and bring your Thoreau if you have it. I want to point out some things in the portable Thoreau to help you through this. Thank you.